From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a good chance you have a vial of essential oil in your house somewhere. Maybe you have a lot of them. They've become incredibly popular lately, like lavender or eucalyptus or frankincense. Some just like the smell. Others think these oils have healing properties. In a new article in the New Yorker magazine, the reporter Rachel Monroe examines the essential oil industry, and the epicenter just happens to be here. The two biggest essential oil multi-level marketers are in Utah County, and each one makes about $1 billion a year. Monroe is joining us today to talk about what she's learned about this business, which also seems like a culture. We'll also talk about how these essential oils work, or if they do work, like some say they do. Are they a perfume or a miraculous potion or both? Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Essential oils are big business these days. You see them everywhere. Lavender oil and rose oil, peppermint, you've got your blends. And a new article for the New Yorker magazine, the reporter Rachel Monroe says this isn't just for the Gwyneth Paltrow crowd. She says you're just as likely to find essential oils in a small town drugstore in the Midwest as an organic market in L.A. these days. And part of what she does in the article is trying to explain their appeal, which she says is less about indulgence than it is about anxiety. Anxiety over an array of modern toxins and viruses, concerns about big pharma. Monroe says some consumers see essential oils as a purer, more ancient form of medicine. But she also gets at the question in the article of whether these oils are medicine at all. She breaks down the claims, the marketing techniques of the industry, which happens to be centered here in Utah County, to be exact, where you'll find two of the biggest essential oil multi-level marketers, doTERRA and Young Living. So today in the program, Rachel Monroe is joining us. Her article is in the October 9th edition of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website. Rachel, I should mention, is a journalist, a writer based in Marfa, Texas. She's joining us today from Marfa Public Radio. And Rachel Monroe, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Rachel Monroe, what got you started on this story? What were you trying to find out? What was thinking?
Sure. To be honest, it started like several years ago, and it took me a long time to get any magazine editors on board. But I would say maybe 3 or 5 years ago, before that, I had never heard the phrase essential oils. Probably had never crossed my path. And then all of a sudden, I started just seeing them pop up and hearing about them. I saw them in a local health food store out here in rural Texas where I live. I saw them at someone selling them at a farmer's market in Minneapolis. I saw them at kind of a fancy grocery store in New York City. And so my journalist radar kind of pinged. I was like, this is a thing. This is a new thing.
Yeah.
Just started feeling it kind of growing and percolating in the culture and just wanted to know what it was all about, where this came from.
You begin the story with a woman named Carla Cohen. Tell a little bit about her story, because I think this is an important way to get into this conversation about how desperate some people get when they find the essential oils, how passionate they can be about all of this. Let's talk about Carla, first of all.
Sure. So Carla lives in Long Beach, California, and she was a very early convert, if we're thinking about this as a more recent trend. About 15 years ago is when she first started getting interested. She had a health crisis. She was a pretty high-powered executive in Hollywood, and she had a sort of mysterious health crisis. Her brain and her body just weren't working right. She felt like her doctors, her traditional doctors, just had no useful information. They would try one medicine, it wouldn't really work. Maybe it would make her feel worse. They would try another, and nobody could really tell her what was wrong with her. At one point, they told her she was depressed, gave her antidepressants, and she was like, "But I'm not depressed." And they were like, "Well, you know, we don't know." And so she went through kind of a journey trying out all sorts of different kinds of alternative treatments. She went to Reiki. She became a massage therapist. And through the course of this journey, she came across essential oils. And as she tells it, it was just kind of love at first sight. She sprinkled some oils on and felt her brain kind of activate in a way that it hadn't before. And now at this point, it's her entire business. She had to leave her previous career because of this mysterious health crisis that she had. And I think she would say that the oils really saved her, both in terms of how she felt physically, and then also because they became, an economic lifeline.
Yeah. She became a distributor for a Young Living.
Yes. She's a Young Living distributor.
Yeah. So she talks about how her the first moment she starts using them, she said that something started firing that hadn't been firing. She talks about that somehow there's some immune system boosting blend that she's used. And these things come up all of the time. On the one hand, they really smell good. It's good for meditation practice. And then the other part of it, which is and some get quite outrageous, the claims, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but it seems like the range of what these oils can do are all over the place.
It's really interesting, too, because Carla Cohen is sort of one of a representative of maybe the older school version of this, where there's a lot of aromatherapy used to be a very fringe new age thing. You would only kind of in these little health food stores or these little new age bookstores would you find anybody who would want to talk to you about aromatherapy. And so she talks about, you know, aligning your DNA and it's kind of framed as this kind of cosmic thing that's happening in your aura, which is not necessarily how everybody who's into oils these days would think about it. But that's certainly used to be the area in which they were most popular.
One of the things you do in the piece is kind of situate this trend in the context of today. Talk a little bit about that, because you say this is part of this kind of embrace of, you know, healthy living practices. As I mentioned in the introduction, referred to your reference to it being less about indulgence these days, as you kind of center it on a kind of anxiety.
Sure. Wellness trends feel really huge right now. I think people are looking for natural treatments, holistic treatments. It ends up being this funny blend of people wanting to take care of their physical health, their medical health, and their psychological health. But then there's often, for women, also like a beauty component. So, you know, you eat this powder or you drink this special tea and it'll make you like look young and feel young and not be depressed anymore. I think a lot of times there are aspects of wellness that get described as being pretty frivolous, and some of it does seem like quite frivolous. There's the famous jade egg that Gwyneth Paltrow sells. The more that I looked into it, the more that seemed like people weren't necessarily just trying to treat themselves to a spa day, but they were really responding to real anxieties about the way that they felt that the contemporary medical system was functioning.
You came to Utah in June. Young Living had this mass, I have to say, it seemed huge.
Yeah.
They sort of took over the city. They had this big convention. I guess they do this from time to time. And we'll get back to that in a moment. But just as you're walking around the place, is there a type? Because you mentioned in the article that the appeal crosses a political spectrum. I mean, it seems like you have the really out there folks, and then you have the kind of Mormon housewife folks. It seems like the type is all over the map, too.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. I talked to a ton of different kinds of people. I saw some Mennonites there. It's like fairly popular in the Mennonite community.
Wow.
I talked to a woman who, a black woman. It was like largely a white crowd, but not entirely, but black woman from Washington, D.C., who like an ardent liberal, There's a big crossover, I think, with faith communities. So there are a lot of biblical references on people's T-shirts and stuff. But you really do see just a wide cross-section of people. I guess the overwhelming impression was that it was certainly primarily women. And the men that were there were, like, usually part of a couple. There are some power couples in the essential oil scene. But very few solo men.
The way essential oils are applied today seems new. They have, you know, these diffusers and all this other stuff. But the oils themselves have been around for a long time. Maybe spend a little bit of time explaining what are essential oils? How do you get essential oils? Because you get at this in the article.
Sure. So I guess at their most basic level, they're just like distilled plant materials. Well, they're either steam distilled or cold pressed. So it's just kind of like the essence of a plant, super concentrated liquid. And like you said, they've been around forever. They're in like any processed food that you eat, anything that has flavoring, any body product that you use that has like natural flavorings or natural scents. Those are essential oils. So for a long time, they were just they were commercially manufactured. Coca-Cola and Pepsi being like the biggest consumers of them, with their special flavor blends, special secret flavor blends. Those are made out of essential oils. But yes, this new use of where you go to the grocery store, or you can even go to Best Buy and buy them these days, and buy them to put in your diffuser to change your mood or to change your health, that's definitely new.
What do you think it means that now pretty much everyone either is using them or knows about them? Because you talk about how they're incredibly resource intensive to produce. There's a kind of an environmental factor to this story that I hadn't realized.
Sure. Yeah, there's just these wild statistics about something like a million rose petals to make like an ounce of rose oil. Rose oil is incredibly expensive. It's like those little bottles that you buy, it would be, $300 or $500.
Wow.
Because it just takes so much plant material to make them. And that's fine for certain plants that can be commercially farmed, like lavender. But then you have other plants like frankincense is a big one that grows only in the wild. And the way that you make frankincense is it's like scraped. There's a tree and you kind of scrape the bark and some resin oozes out and you use that as the basis for your frankincense oil. But you can only harvest it so often. If you kind of scrape the tree too often, the tree dies. The frankincense market is most of the trees are in the Horn of Africa, and it's people's only source of income passed down through generations in this area where there's a huge drought. So a lot of other sources of income are drying up. So there's a real fear that the frankincense forests are just being like unsustainably harvested because there's so much demand. A woman who is kind of a sustainability consultant in that area was like, there's a real risk that if this is not managed properly, then we might like run out of frankincense trees. We might kill all of our frankincense trees.
You also raise the question of whether the companies like doTERRA or Young Living, if they can provide a steady supply with so much demand, and whether or not they're going to be able to stay, quote unquote, pure. Because there's this big question, I guess, in the industry about how pure they are, how much can you use synthetic oils, how does that work?
That's like sort of tricky territory to wander into because, what is purity and how do you prove that something is pure? I'm walking on dangerous ground, I feel like. But basically these two companies, most of the companies that sell oils like for therapeutic reasons, like to claim that you need really pure oils because otherwise they won't work or they'll be dangerous. Now the danger question seems somewhat up in the air for me because like we're all, like I said, essential oils, synthetic oils, Coca-Cola and Pepsi are using synthetic oils or oils that are a mix of natural and synthetic for their products. We all consume synthetic oils all the time.
Yeah.
There's nothing inherently ominous about something like a synthesized molecule. But there is a real, these companies, they're selling themselves as being pure and natural being better. And in most cases, they're the only ones policing themselves. There isn't sort of a independent board that tests oils and, you know, certifies this is pure, or that is not pure. So you're basically taking companies' claims at face value. Some of them publish their testing results online. But then you'll have something from, you know, you'll have an oil sold at Walmart for, you know, frankincense oil for $2 or something. And it says it's natural, therapeutic grade. And you realize that those phrases don't mean anything. There's nobody policing the use of those phrases. Therapeutic grade is stamped all over the place and literally does not mean anything.
I actually want to get back to that here in a moment when we talk about it, whether the FDA can regulate an industry like this. But let me get to a question that some people are asking. Here's an email from Shelley who writes, I'm entirely baffled by this trend, especially since Mormons seem to be particularly susceptible to it. Is there a connection there? What did you find? You mentioned that there's a kind of a spiritual component or a religious component to some of the people who are interested in all of this. But of course, the epicenter, as I mentioned, of essential oils, at least the multi-level marketing part of it, is here in Utah, mostly Mormon. What is there a connection? Did you see one?
Sure. Some of the top executives in both companies, both companies that I write about, doTERRA and Young Living, are members of the Mormon Church. doTERRA executives told me that in a lot of ways, if you're starting up a company like this, doTERRA is a newer company, that the Mormon community is actually a great resource. It's a naturally networked community. You have a lot of stay-at-home moms who are, in many cases, the people who are the foundation of this business in a lot of ways. And so they marketed certainly to those stay-at-home moms. And I think just because they geographically began here, it started out, Utah was the number one consumer of oils. And now I think it's spread all over the country. And now it's... they're often sold within church communities, not necessarily the Mormon church, but just people always talk about these biblical references to essential oils, which are not. I saw a woman at the Young Living conference who had a quote from Genesis about essential oils, and I looked for it forever, and it's just really not in the Bible. But there is a feeling that there's a connection that this is God's medicine. This is a kind of ancient, pure medicine. This is the way that God wants us to heal ourselves.
You quote in the article a man by the name of David Stewart, who's this aromatherapist who is affiliated with Young Living. And he says mentions about these oils that they're intended to serve us and heal us according to the highest will of their creator and our creator, who is one and the same God. This is a former United Methodist pastor. The language, the religious language in this is pretty interesting.
Yeah, you would hear, I've heard a lot of people kind of talk about essential oils as this kind of ideal, perfect medicine. Something that somebody told me that, you know, like they could never hurt you because they have this divine wisdom, and they'll give your cells exactly what they need. And then if they notice that your cells don't need anything, then they'll reject it. And this medicine is somehow has this divine intelligence that other kinds of medicine don't.
I wanted to ask you about. One of the things that comes through in the piece is just how earnest these people are. Really, I have to say, really touching stories of people who are looking for something to kind of salve the pain or give them a fulfilling cause. There's a story you tell of Laura Warford, And these oils came into her life. They really calmed her when she had lost a newborn baby. Just talk a little bit about that. There's a kind of a vulnerable segment to this population, it seems.
Certainly. Yeah. It was a funny experience being at the convention, and I would ask people like, oh, do you know anyone who has sort of a dramatic story or who felt that oils really changed their lives? And nearly everybody I asked that question to was like, oh, me. And they would share these incredibly sad, intimate stories of, just like you said, these vulnerable moments in their lives when they lost a child or received a really alarming diagnosis. In many cases, actually, a husband lost a job and there was a lot of stress in the household, and the oils provided maybe some psychological support, but also a community, because these are intensely networked businesses. So people are always kind of talking to each other on these Facebook groups. And I think people got a lot of solace from having somebody to just share their stories with, and also like a purpose. People talked about like, oh, I have a purpose to get out of bed. You know, I have to run my business, to sell my oils. And it allowed them to sort of feel like they were doing something and moving forward after these moments of vulnerability.
Dennis is joining us in Salt Lake City. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Doug. So last year I had a broken face. Half my face was a jigsaw puzzle. And a family member gave me essential oils and to, I guess, rub on my face or something. And I didn't use them because I thought that seems silly that some oils could fix the bones. And so my question is, and I have a comment. My question is there any real pathway for oils to fix bones? And then I'd like your guess. My comment is, they call them essential oils, but it seems the only thing they're essential to is plant life.
We'll get back to the plant life question here in a moment. Dennis, thanks. Let's get to that question, because I think, Rachel Monroe, it's a big one. There are a lot of claims here about what essential oils could or possibly couldn't do. I mean, you hear Carla, for example, early in your piece, where she talks about how they can detox the body or clear a foggy mind. And she talks about how you can take certain oils and rub them clockwise 3 times to activate what she said were these electrical properties in the skin. I mean, what do you make of that? Because there's that, and then you get these kind of vague terms that they use, and then some people go out there and say, this will keep you from contracting Ebola. It can cure Alzheimer's and cancer, and, you know, autism comes up all the time in these conversations, it seems. And, I mean, how do you police this, and can, as Dennis said, an essential oil do any of those things?
Well, broken bones, it's hard for me to, I'm sure there's somebody out there who could sell you a story, but it's hard for me to understand how that would make any sense at all. As I understand it, and I spent a lot of time looking at the research, people who sell oils will tell you, oh, there are thousands of studies. There are 2,000 studies. There are 2,000 studies, and look it up in PubMed. And if you do look essential oils up in PubMed, which is the database of peer-reviewed research, medical research, what you'll find is quite a few studies making all sorts of really kind of encouraging claims. But most of those are experiments done in petri dishes. So you're like, oh, okay, essential oils, tea tree oil will have a strong antibiotic effect, but of course, like tequila in a petri dish will also have kill a lot of bacteria. So it's a question of dosage and percentage and, how much can you extrapolate from what happens in a cell culture to what happens in a human body. And so a lot of claims kind of get distorted and amplified to a wild extent, and sometimes a very alarming extent.
Yeah.
From that research, from people who maybe don't have a ton of scientific training or aren't reading those papers themselves, but are sort of like seeing a Facebook post that maybe misrepresents or overstates something. And then you have people, just like you said, a few years ago, both Young Living and doTERRA got in trouble for distributors making claims like, you know, brain injury, autism, Ebola, that oils can prevent you from getting Ebola. So that they got some pretty stern letters from the FDA saying, like, you need to make sure these claims are not being made.
You talked to representatives of both of the companies. One of them from doTERRA said that they try to police these things among their distributors, going online, looking at their social media accounts. And when they find stuff like, hey, this will cure autism, they flag it, I guess, and tell them to stop saying that. I mean, it must be hard to police these thousands and millions of distributors.
Sure. Well, and doTERRA was much more open with me, so I have a lot more to – I know a lot more intimately kind of what their process is, so I can talk with much more knowledgeable – in a much more knowledgeable way about what they do. They have, I think, a 50-person team and some software that kind of crawls the web and looks for these key phrases. And then if they find a claim that is it seems like it has – the FDA wouldn't like it, then they ask people to take it down. But like you said, there are these millions of distributors. And while maybe you can use software to police what they say online, they are certainly saying things in person that there's no way to police.
Did the Young Living people talk to you? It seems like they were less transparent.
They were. I got an email response to some questions from a spokesperson.
But that's about it.
Yeah.
We'll come back to Young Living. I think the story of their founder, Gary Young, is fascinating, which you tell in the story. Rachel Monroe is with us. Her article, How Essential Oils Became the Cure for Our Age of Anxiety, appears in the October 9th issue of The New Yorker magazine. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the reporter Rachel Monroe. She has an article in the New Yorker magazine where she came to Utah to explore the essential oil phenomenon, how they've come to be seen, she says, as a cure for our age of anxiety. She's joining us from a studio in Marfa Public Radio, Marfa, Texas. Let's go back to the phones. Pam is with us in Salt Lake. Pam, hi.
Hi, Doug. So my question's more about kind of the business model. So it's just funny because I work right in town in Salt Lake, and I just drove by the Salt Cliff where they're having the huge Nu Skin convention. And I see these groups all the time. And I just wonder, how are people making money? Who are they selling all of this essential oil and other products to? Are people actually making money? I know that, multi-level marketing depends on people keep on bringing their friends and neighbors in. But I'm just interested in knowing, I see these thousands of people and I wonder, are people actually making money and who are they selling all of this product to?
Yeah. Let's start with the model, Rachel Monroe. It's a pretty straightforward multi-level marketing model, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have a downline. So you, if you sell the products, if you're a distributor, then you get a percentage of your sales kind of comes back to you as a kind of commission. And then your downline, the people that you recruit who also sell, you get a percentage of their sales as well. So the higher up you are in the hierarchy, the more people you have working below you, the more money you make.
It's not a pyramid scheme technically. But you say there are some comparisons to it.
Sure. And a pyramid scheme is illegal. And in a pyramid scheme, there's no market outside the pyramid itself. It's basically like a trap. And for all these companies, there is ostensibly a way to sell to an outside market, to sell retail, and maybe you could make money. But in many cases, the way that it's structured, you just have a ton of people at the, it's hard to not describe it as a pyramid. Yeah. There's a ton of people at the base who are making no money or maybe only spending money. And then you have a few people at the elite levels, a few dozen, a few hundred people who are making quite a bit of money. But the vast majority, over 90%, are making no money or are spending more than they make. So I guess in that case, you can't really call it a business.
You write this, according to a public income statement, more than 94% of Young Living's 2 million active members made less than a dollar in 2016. Less than 0.1%, it's about 1,000 people on this level called the Royal Crown Diamonds, 0.1% earned more than $1 million. So it's pretty have-nots kind of idea, I guess.
Sure. And I mean, at the Young Living convention that I attended, I just kept thinking about the idea of the American dream, you know, this mythology that if you just work really hard, then you can rise. That was, in a lot of the business talks, that was the kind of almost like an anthem. I went to one business building lecture, and there was a woman on stage who was a Royal Crown Diamond, I believe, and she was just like, you know, anybody can do this. If you're not a diamond level, it's just because you're not working hard enough. You know, any of us could get here. And I think a lot. And I talked to people who were just starting out, who are at the very lowest level of the company, who really felt convinced that they were going to be the ones. They knew only a few people rose to the top, but they were really convinced that it was going to be them. And I think just statistics and history show that it's really not. People who get in early in these companies have a huge advantage. And just often also a problem that people are finding now is that markets are saturated. Right. So if you live in a small town and you become the 12th Young Living distributor, the number of people that you have to sell to is just very, very small. And so a lot of people, I think, come in with big dreams of making a bunch of money and end up, in the case of the people who spend more than they make.
You know, reading the piece, you get a sense that there's this kind of odd mix of materialism. People are constantly talking about the luxuries in their lives, even though money, saying the word money is a taboo, you say. There's the mix between that materialism and then sort of charity. I mean, they use the words like blessed and abundance. And but they're also talking about how you can have these really cool houses and multiple cars and swimming pools and stuff.
Yeah, it felt like a very confused message. I mean, nobody would tell. I would always ask, like, oh, how do you feel about the selling? Is the selling hard? And it was almost like everybody was reading from the same script. They're like, oh, no, I don't feel like I'm selling. You know, they just sell themselves. It's like sharing. I don't have to do any work. I love them so much. And they're so wonderful. These products just sell themselves. But if you kind of start asking more questions or poke around online and read people's testimonials, it does end up being a ton of work just to try to move product. You have a lot of people reaching out on social media, and I think this is where some of the backlash comes from, because some of us on our social media feeds will have just dozens of people pushing these products, or you know, you have a friend request or a message from somebody you haven't seen since high school. And they're just trying to, you know, change your life through an oil or whatever other multi-level product they're selling to you.
It's, I mean, it's interesting that that's one of the things you talk about, is that they're taking advantage. Part of the model is taking advantage of your social connections, which you mentioned, you know, Mary Kay Cosmetics, they do the same thing. Amway did the same thing. You find people who, this has happened to all of us in high school, somebody who we knew in high school, sort of, and they say, hey, it's kind of a strategy. It's one of the things they do.
Sure. If you go online and read the tips for, you know, how to have a successful network marketing business, You'll read about things like, oh, you know, reach out to five strangers a day, reach out to five people you haven't talked to in a decade every day. You know, post some product testimonials, like you should be doing at least 7 or 8 posts a day about your product. And you start to understand just how our feeds get so clogged. And I think that's another reason these companies have really skyrocketed in recent years, is it used to be like with Mary Kay or with Amway, these were sold person to person. You know, you would bring them into the office, or you would host a party. But your network is sort of just naturally limited by the people that you geographically surround yourself with. And now that we have these huge social networks that we participate in, you can sell to people or try to sell to people across the country, across the world, just, you know, staying at home.
Yeah. Maybe say something about that ethnographic study that you refer to in the article. This was conducted 17 years ago or so, and this was about Amway distributors. And talk a little bit about what that may have revealed about companies like Amway or Young Living or doTERRA.
Sure. It was a really fascinating article. It was a guy who became an Amway distributor for a year or so as an anthropologist to sort of figure out, like, how does this work? Why do people stay with this company? It doesn't offer any of the traditional benefits of work, right? It doesn't have a steady income. You don't get any benefits. There's not sort of a workplace that you can go to and have social connections. The business has no loyalty to you. You're not really protected in any way. And what he found, and I think this holds true for today's multi-level marketing company, was that Amway was really successful at creating a kind of shared culture, an idea of an idealized way of being. It's like we work hard and we're positive and we're independent and we have freedom, and the company kind of came to embody all those abstract ideals. And so people identified with it really strongly, so strongly that they were willing to stick around, even if maybe economically it didn't make sense. They were getting these other benefits from feeling like they belonged to something bigger than them.
So it doesn't matter that their garage is full of boxes of unopened product that they cannot manage to move. They get some kind of shared cultural identity.
Right. But I mean, you do. I heard from people who reached out to me, you know, does it matter is a good question. I heard from people who were like, oh, this, my wife's oil business basically broke up our marriage. So I think maybe in some ways it can draw you into one community and maybe cut you off from others would be the risk.
Let me ask you this before we head into a break. I've always wondered, could these companies make it in a conventional market structure? You know, just on the quality and the popularity of their products. If they didn't have, you know, the culture, the conventions, the lingo, the sales pressure, is there any... Do you have any idea of whether they could make it?
That's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, I know that doTERRA is intentionally not a member of the Direct Selling Association. They want to distance themselves. They understand that, you know, multi-level marketing, network marketing, that for a lot of the people, those are really negative terms. And so they don't sort of position themselves as such. And so then I asked, you know, like, well, then why do you still sell them this way? And their answer was like, oh, it's person to person is so important. That's how you share information. But it's my hunch that creating this strong, the culture, you're selling a culture as much as you're selling a product. And if you sell kind of traditional retail, there's just not that all that apparatus around it is so key and is what people really love and respond to just as much as the products.
Rachel Monroe is with us. We have a link to her New Yorker article, How Essential Oils Became the Cure for Our Age of Anxiety, on our website, radiowest.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brandon, hang on. We'll be back. Get to your question right after a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're speaking with reporter Rachel Monroe about her piece in The New Yorker magazine, How Essential Oils Became the Cure for Our Age of Anxiety. There's a link to the article on our website at radiowest.org. Rachel's joining us today from Marfa Public Radio in Texas. Brandon has been waiting. Brandon, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a quick comment. I'm an emergency physician and ER doctor in Salt Lake and Utah counties. And while I consider essential oils to be a profound waste of money, I'm completely comfortable letting adults make their own bad decisions. In the case of kids, though, I have to urge parents to take their kids to the doctor if they're sick. Three times in just the last couple years, I've taken care of a profoundly ill child who had a condition that would have been easily treatable, but whose parents refused to treat them with anything besides oils. And all three of these kids had to spend very lengthy times in the hospital. One had to get put on a ventilator and very nearly died. And all this could have been prevented with actual medicines and an early visit to the pediatrician. So my comment to the public is, you know, adults, if you buy oils for yourself, treat your anxiety, great. If you want your kids to thrive and be well, then please take them to the doctor.
You deal with this, Rachel Monroe, in the story. You mention, and I'll just read this here, in Utah County, the hub of the state's alternative health industry, 43% of kindergartners have not received their full suite of vaccinations. There's a weird irony there. What can you say to Brandon's comment?
Yeah, that's just a really alarming story. And I think it's so important to hear things like that. It's the flip side, right, of the idea of oils as this God molecule. I think people have an outsized faith in what they think these things can do, so they don't use traditional medicines. And then also there are cases of essential oils actually harming people when they are ingested. Some of them are toxic. Sometimes they're incredibly concentrated. So you have people kind of drinking drops of them or putting them on their skin, as that previous caller said that somebody told him to do. And that can be really harmful in some cases if it's done sort of without proper knowledge. There was a terrible case of a woman who had second degree burns over the summer. She kind of slathered her face in some sort of, I think it was a citrus oil before a hot yoga class, and then went to a tanning bed and just erupted in these terrible blisters. And there is a little warning on the citrus oil that she used that says, you know, photosensitive. But she didn't really know what that meant, or she didn't read it closely, or she didn't pay attention to it. And so the sense that these are, you know, they can only help you and they can't harm you, I think is we're seeing that play out as false more and more, either because people are neglecting real treatment or are misusing these treatments.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Back to the phones. And Christy is joining
Hi,
us
Doug.
In Riverton. Hi, Christy. Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to just make a comment. My father had suffered from kidney stones, and my mother was approached by an oil distributor also, and she was told that the oils would cure his kidney stones. And working in a couple of medical industry and different things, I told her, well, look at this. And it denoted a study in the footnote that supposedly supported this. So I showed her how to search the study. And when we pulled it up, the study was done only in 10 rats. So I didn't feel that was sufficient.
No. Well, Rachel Monroe, we were talking a little bit about this. Let's talk about the FDA. Can the FDA regulate essential oils?
So they are classified as cosmetic products. So with that classification, then they can't be regulated by the FDA, and also you can't make medical claims about them because they're not a medical product. And it's my sense that these companies really don't want them to be medical products because then they are much more policed. Mm-hmm. And so technically, you're not supposed to make claims about them treating, curing, preventing disease. And that's what, you know, we were talking about doTERRA kind of trawling the social media to make sure those claims aren't made. But people make just the most amazing kind of person-to-person claims. And that's sort of my concern is like you, especially with the multi-level marketing structure, there's an incentive there, right, to make the most extreme claims possible. Yeah. You know, this will cure your kidney stones or your autism or whatever. And there's people with no training at all. And talking to people in vulnerable situations, as you mentioned, with no oversight.
You say they often get around all of this by using really vague terms like vitality and balance.
Right. And you can't say, oh, this will cure your headache or this is better than an aspirin. But you can say, you know, you can talk about general body systems. You can say, you know, improves digestive health or enhances brain function. Maybe that one last one wouldn't be OK. But there are these kind of code words that they use that that are OK with the FDA because they're just vague enough. But hopefully your audience knows what you mean. And all the distributors just are so upset. All the ones that I spoke with just hate the FDA, hate these rules. They want to be able to, you know, make the claims that they think are true. And compliance is a dirty word to a lot of people.
Rex is with us in Salt Lake. Rex, hi.
Hi. I'm a Utah boy, and so I've learned to either love or hate the multi-level marketing model. And unfortunately, I listened to Frontline On Point on the same subject. And I think she's being really kind to the industry. I think it's really great that she's so balanced. And I've gotten two questions.
Give us one.
Okay. Wasn't Senator Hatch one of the people that sort of blocked regulation of multi-level marketing, the multi-level marketing model and the FDA
supplements,
sort of going after it?
I don't know, Rachel Monroe, it doesn't seem to me you're terribly kind, although you are, I think Rex is right, you're pretty balanced in the piece. Is there a political component? You don't really go into that. Senator Hatch has been one of those who's been really fighting for supplement makers. I'm not sure if essential oils plays into that. It seems it could, I suppose.
Well, sure. I mean, there are kind of vague political happenings out there. People often frame it in terms of freedom, both for regulating multi-level marketing and also for supplement companies. That's often pitted. You'll see Orrin Hatch talk about this, like as you know, the freedom to make choices, regulation as some sort of intrusion on your sovereign individuality. And I do think that a lot of that rhetoric plays into this industry, too. I mean, and in terms of being gentle on, I guess how I came out of this feeling is a lot of sympathy for a lot of the individuals who are involved in this industry. There's a lot of sincere people, a lot of people who get something out of, they're doing this because they get something out of it. That might not be money, but they're making a choice. And then kind of the higher you go up into the companies, the people who are kind of making the calls and organizing this industry, the less sympathy that I have.
Yeah.
But the people are sincere and they're not stupid.
Which may bring us to Gary Young, who's one of the founders of this Young Living company. You know, he has a kind of dicey past. I mean, you write about he was arrested for practicing medicine without a license, told some undercover detectives he could detect cancer with a blood test, went to Tijuana, opened a clinic there, sounds like a really tragic story at a birthing center where his own baby daughter died tragically, left too long in a whirlpool bath. He's got a clinic in Ecuador now, this Gary Young, where he has no medical license or degree, but some say he's conducted gallbladder surgery. I mean, I don't know. What can you say about that?
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure. I think in the first time I pitched this, I called him the L. Ron Hubbard of natural medicine, and maybe that's unfair, but it's not that far off. He's just a really charismatic figure. True believer, has a lot of out there beliefs. If you kind of read his older lectures about the, you know, kind of auras and DNA alignment and energy fields, and is the one who really drove this industry in a lot of ways through sort of the force of his personality and his charisma. But just like you said, there's a lot of really alarming stories. There's also a woman. He had a clinic in Utah where a woman ended up settling for a ton of money. She almost died from getting these vitamin C infusions and had to be, you know, rushed to the hospital on the brink of death. Just these really kind of extreme approaches to treatment that seem to, in some cases, have really caused a lot of harm. But people have a lot of, well, people either seem to love him or hate him.
Yeah, that's true. Which leads us, we're pretty much out of time, but just finally, are you seeing any halt in the momentum, or are they cruising, these companies?
Well, I think they certainly seem to be cruising. I do think saturation is part of the problem. You know, there's just only going to be a certain number of people who are interested in this. And I think that people have come into the business with kind of starry eyes about how much money they're going to make and how it's going to change their life. And I think the reality is a lot of people's their lives aren't changed. And maybe some people will still stick around nonetheless, but a lot of them probably won't.
It's Rachel Monroe. We have a link to her article in The New Yorker, How Essential Oils Became the Cure for Our Age of Anxiety. It's at radiowest.org. Rachel joined us from Marfa Public Radio. Rachel, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our thanks also to Tim Slover today. I'm Doug Fabrizio.